Society of Innovators in Northwest Indiana once again putting out its monthly awards, and one of these now going to Tri-Creek School Corporation Superintendent Deborah Howe. Deborah, thanks for being with us on Regionally Speaking today.
Thank you.
Tell us a little bit about the idea behind problem-based learning here in Northwest Indiana, how the Tri-Creek School Corporation is taking advantage of that, and in turn, what basically got the school corporation and you as the superintendent the honor for this month's Innovation Award.
When I was hired here at Tri-Creek School Corporation, they wanted to make sure that our students had an instructional program that was very hands-on, that had more of an application base, that not only dealt with the knowledge that kids would need, but also with the skill sets for that particular class in order to move to the next grade level, and then also for college and careers and for life in general. And when we went looking at the various models, and we, as a committee for our district, we reviewed a variety of transformational models. And then we settled on the new tech framework, which is project-based learning, in that you will be given a problem or a scenario that you're going to have to research and then answer a series of questions or problems. And you do that collaboratively with other students within the class, and then you end up having a presentation. And we are a one-to-one technology district. We use MacBook Airs in grades 3 through 12. And so you're using the technology to do that research, to connect with folks within particular careers or who have expertise in areas so that you can dig deeper into the problem or the project that you are working on.
What project in particular that do you find that the Tri-Creek School Corporation could not only benefit from as a school district, but also that the students in the district might be able to benefit from?
It's a really good question. So our mission statement is that the Tri-Creek School Corporation and community are engaged to learn, equipped to achieve, and empowered to succeed. And with project-based learning, therefore, in what way can you take the learning that's going on in the classroom and apply it to a real-world situation? And can you have an impact on the world around you? That's what our students did in their eighth grade science class several years ago. They were studying alternative energy. And they were looking at the energy costs, the electrical costs, for the middle school. And they were just amazed at how high of cost that was. And so they began exploring solar energy and bio energy and wind energy and all of those. And they made a presentation to the school corporation, to the school board, actually, and encouraged them to begin looking at some alternatives. As a result, we took 3 years, and we did study all of the energy, and we landed on solar arrays. And so we developed a pilot, a 90 solar panel pilot. And then we received a $100,000 grant from the Indiana Energy Commission, and we put in another 180. So we had 270 panels to do a pilot for. And we found out that we could offset about 80% of our transportation electrical costs from that. Mm-hmm. As a result, then, we began looking at how we might impact the entire district to offset costs. And as a result, then, we have moved forward and we have awarded the project to two vendors, and we will be putting 6,600 solar panels on over four of our five schools.
Wow, that's great. How much do you hope to save in the Tri-Creek School Corporation with these additional panels to expand this much to be able to save on your electrical bills?
Well, we expect to save about $250,000 a year over the next 30 years, and that will be in excess of over $4 million over our initial cost. So we will offset a little over $7 million over 30 years. And then that money goes into our general fund to help in our personnel costs. Mm-hmm.
I understand, too, that part of the project that they picked up the Innovation Award from the Society of Innovators also looks into, as you mentioned, what the students are learning, the problem-based learning gets expanded as well to help their overall experiences and get to be able to be involved in manufacturing, or at least advanced manufacturing, at the high school level. What is the plan for that that's gotten this innovative idea going?
Career tech education is inherently project-based. It's very hands-on, and students are very engaged. And what we've been looking at is, obviously, is how do you connect what they're learning to the real world? And in Northwest Indiana, manufacturing jobs are in high need. So we are looking at building, starting this summer, we're constructing an advanced manufacturing technical trades building that's going to increase our automotive program as well as our agricultural program. But we'll also be initiating a welding curriculum and a computer-integrated manufacturing using CNC machines. And those, in particular, go back to the trades. We're looking for partnerships with the trades because we know that there are training that's going on, but they're farther away from here, and we believe that there are folks in our area that would need to be retrained or have some additional training, and they could do it closer to home.
Do you think, too, that if that the center set up, the students get to learn these skills and become tradespeople in their own right, that that will attract more businesses into South Lake County in particular, since you have all that area around there that could be developed into some manufacturing space and the like, that if they have the employees to be able to work the equipment, that they'll have the companies come in to take advantage of it?
Yep, that's our hope.
Well, so certainly it's a great hope, and it's nice to hear, too. It's interesting how we see these changes happen over recent years when we think that not so many decades ago, a lot of school districts used to have what were called shop classes or industrial arts classes. That seems to have kind of gone by the wayside with the technology change to where we are today. But don't you agree that we're finding that that's kind of come back to basics, so to speak?
Well, I think that those courses have always been important, but yes, our focus has had turned to college, and students have interest in a variety of areas. But one of the things that we do know is students going into the trades have got to have a high level of reading and math, because reading technical manuals is extremely difficult, and we really certainly want them to understand what they're reading, because they're going to be working on our cars and our machines and those types of things. But then on the other hand, students going into college need to have that practical experience so that they understand how what they're learning is going to be utilized in the real world. So all of our students now are in career pathways, and we are seeing an increase in concentrators and completers in the various career pathways. And we hope that they will be, we expect that they will be, better prepared when they go on to college or when they go into that career, be it right outside of high school or after the college level, because they have an understanding of how what they're learning applies to that profession and to the world.
What kind of feedback or response have you gotten from not only your school board members, but members of the community there in South Lake County about what the Tri-Creek School Corporation is doing, taking advantage, at least on the learning level here, first, that in turn has expanded into a great solar array and energy savings to the school district, and now this expansion plans for the advanced manufacturing facility at the high school?
Well, when it comes to our students, they did not realize that they could have a significant impact on their school and their community even at a young age, and that is starting to become a reality, that they do have an understanding, and we value what their knowledge and their work and their opinions. The second thing is that our graduation rate through all of this, as well as the support structures we have put in place to help students, has gone from 87% to 99.3% in 2014 and 15, and leveled out at 98.1% this past year. So we've seen at least a 12% increase over the past 5 years.
It's probably very, very comforting to not only the students, but the family members as well, and the rest of the community, to see students come out of the high school there in Tri-Creek School Corporation and going on to some great jobs, jobs that are technical-based and in turn earning good wages. And in turn, the family members probably feel good, too, that their youngsters are getting out of high school.
Absolutely. We've seen students that are graduating with academic and technical honors go from 19.8% to 34%.
Wow.
And students earning dual credits in 2010-11, we had 46 dual credits earned, and in 15-16, we had 2,897 credits earned, and that translates back to money into the parents' pockets. We've also initiated an early college scholarship so that our students can take advantage of some scholarships while they are still in high school. So if you're in high school at Tri-Creek and you applied for a scholarship because you want to take a college-level course or you want to get a certification in one of the career pathways, then we have money that is provided, you know, by the Education Foundation to help you do that. Because we want you to go as far as you can while you have the support of the school corporation.
We'll be talking with Tri-Tree School Corporation Superintendent Deborah Howe. The school corporation has picked up an Innovators of the Month award from the Society of Innovators in Northwest Indiana for the project that started out as a student-piloted project-based learning initiative on solar energy and now is expanding the entire school district on to advanced manufacturing and efforts at the high school to be able to prepare students for great technical jobs in the business world as well as in the manufacturing world. Dr. Howe, thank you very much for being with us, and we appreciate another comments. Once again, congratulations to you for picking up the award this month.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Suicide remains the second leading cause of death for Hoosier teens and for young adults. That's according to a just-released report. And as Indiana Public Broadcasting's Eric Weddle discovered, everyone, from lawmakers to school leaders, are looking for ways to prevent another death.
When students at Cathedral High School in Indianapolis want to talk with someone or they're in crisis, they go see Rebecca Pavlik-Hager.
I am a licensed clinical mental health counselor and also a licensed clinical addiction counselor.
She doesn't work alone. Finn, a 2-year-old brown labradoodle, is her 4-legged partner.
Leave it. Sometimes it's like having a 2-year-old in our building. But he goes to classes. He is in the hallway. Kids will literally just stroke him as he goes down the hall. There's just something about a dog who will accept you no matter what your day has been like.
Most school days you'll find him lounging in her office or roaming the halls. He and Hager are part of the Catholic school's robust student wellness and mental health services. It's an effort mostly born out of tragedies of fall 2014. That's when a cathedral student took his own life. And a few weeks later, a junior did the same.
I think that's what really kind of rocked our souls a bit, to say, golly, this is... this is something that could happen every day.
Dave Orland has been Cathedral's principal for 17 years. He says the death spurred new training and an openness about mental health issues. Now all staff are trained to use a technique called QPR.
Question, persuade, and refer.
If staff notice a sudden change in students' behavior or hear them talking about their own death, they'll let a counselor know.
We kind of train throughout the year when little triggers come up or if we get someone who's maybe we're concerned about.
And that response is directly related to the 2 student suicides, deaths that are counted in this year's child wellness report by the Indiana Youth Institute. Tammy Silverman, the group's president, says Indiana ranks higher than the national average in 4 categories related to teen suicide.
The number of kids who have contemplated suicide, the actual number of teens who have a plan, those that have attempted, and those that have attempted and need medical intervention.
And what's the cause? Silverman says there's no single reason.
The largest one, of course, contributing factor is depression, and particularly undiagnosed depression. Now, what makes our teens depressed is the next logical question, of course, and that has to do with a lot of different factors.
Things like homelessness, bullying, cyberbullying, or a parent's job loss.
So really the data is the starting point for the conversations to now what do we do and how do we work together to make sure we're addressing these issues.
At the State House, lawmakers are trying to do just that. Debate is ongoing for 2 bills that have received unanimous support in their original chambers.
The roll call shows 93 ayes, 0 noes.
The roll call shows 49 ayes, 0 nays. The bill's passed their head.
Lawmakers want to prevent teen suicide, but they aren't sure how. The House proposal would require school employees working with students in 7th to 12th grade to have at least 2 hours of suicide prevention training every other year. The Senate bill doesn't require training, but calls for a statewide suicide prevention coordinator. This person would create programming and figure out which professionals in Indiana should be required to have the suicide prevention training. Mindy Goodpaster, a director at the Marion County Commission on Youth, supports the Senate bill. She told a committee, schools can't bear the burden of preventing suicides.
Looking at the community as a whole and how we all come together to support youth, because youth taking their own lives is one of the saddest tragedies. It's completely preventable, and we need to do more.
At Cathedral High School, mental health counselor Hager and her principal are glad lawmakers are paying attention to the issue. Hager says she knows focusing on mental health can have a real impact.
Now when we call a parent to say, and we're questioning, we think your child may be depressed, a parent's listening now. I think the reality of this is something that does happen parents have really taken the message to heart.
State House debate on the suicide prevention bills will continue throughout March. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Eric Weddle in Indianapolis.
Members of the community, along with businesses and nonprofits, will gather tomorrow at the County Line Orchard in Porter County for what is being called FED, Food Expo and Discussion. It's a program that is being put on by the Northwest Indiana Food Council, and we have the board president of the Northwest Indiana Food Council, Sarah Hyland, with us. Sarah, thanks for joining us here on Regionally Speaking.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
Well, take a moment first and tell us what the Northwest Indiana Food Council is all about and what got you all interested in creating this very first event, the Food Expo and Discussion.
Sure. The NWI Food Council is a multi-stakeholder alliance, and we're working to build a just, sustainable, and thriving locally oriented food system for everyone in our region throughout Northwest Indiana. And so what got us interested in this event is, and putting on this event, is we're a pretty new organization. We've been around a little bit over a year, and we're really looking to connect with more of the people across the region who are already involved in local food, whether they're food producers or nonprofits and people who are already working on other local food projects. So the theme of the event this year is actually cultivating connections. So the idea is we bring everybody together under one roof to work on these projects together.
It's a great opportunity to collaborate and to bring people together, like you mentioned, a little networking sessions all through the day, I guess. And I know that some of the topics that are going to come up here are things like community gardens and, in particular, urban farming. Tell us about a couple pastors in Gary have been working on some projects in the Steel City. Tell us what they're going to be bringing to the table for the conference tomorrow.
Yeah, we've got four different educational sessions in the morning, and that's about a third of our event will focus on these panel discussions. And so one of those panel discussions is about urban farming and community gardens, and we'll have Pastor Whitaker from Progressive Community Church and Faith Farms. And Faith Farms is an urban farm next door to the church there in Gary, that has been in operation for about 4 years. And this past summer, some volunteers from the Food Council came and joined dozens of other volunteers there at the site to help build hoop houses so that they could grow year-round. And so Pastor Whitaker will be there talking about their project. And then we will also have Pastor Henderson of Peace Garden and Farms in Gary talking about their urban farm.
One of the topics we've had on recently here during the afternoons on Lakeshore Public Radio is, of course, our Chef Nick segment. And the last segment talked about all kinds of interesting seafood. And in particular, we've got seafood on the menu, so to speak, on the discussion listing for tomorrow, about how one resident in Valparaiso has been able to make some seafood available on a regular basis. She grows it at home. Tell us about that.
Yeah, it's pretty neat. So Jennifer Shellhart will be one of our panelists in our aquaponics panel. And we're kind of trying to hit every angle with these panels. So we want to have something that's interesting for entrepreneurs or people who would like to become entrepreneurs. We'd like to have topics that are interesting for nonprofits. And we also have topics that are interesting for, you know, regular consumers, for folks who are just sort of interested in maybe eating healthier or just into food in general. And so Jennifer's going to be a neat one for the consumer audience, because she actually has an aquaponics set up in her basement where she can go downstairs and harvest fresh tilapia for dinner.
Wow, that's very good. That's a good idea, a good topic to take on as a hobby if you like fish and if you don't mind setting aside some space in your basement for all the things that you'll need to be able to do a hydroponics. That's a great way to do it.
Definitely. And she doesn't even have, you know, a special sort of background that enabled her to do this. You don't have to be a science major. Basically, she's going to show people how anyone could create a setup like this and have that level of sort of self-sufficiency and fresh food at their fingertips, which is pretty neat.
One of the other discussion topics that's going to be coming up tomorrow at the Food Expo and Discussion is going to be one with Nate Laux with the PAX Center in La Porte. What is Nate going to bring in to talk to residents about in food-related projects?
Yeah, so this is a neat one that we're excited about. That panel is entitled Community Project Design, and it's intended for folks who are maybe sort of thinking about developing a project in their area, you know, maybe you know about food that goes to waste that gets left behind by harvesters, or, you know, in other scenarios, maybe you want to start a food gleaning program for farms, or maybe you want to start a garden gleaning program to collect produce for a food pantry or something like that. So whatever that project might be that you have in mind, this panel aims to walk participants through the steps to designing a community project, getting people involved. And Pastor Nate Laux is from the PAC Center in La Porte, and he'll talk about how they designed that space and how they put together they have a really incredible program there. So he'll also be joined by Sarah Stewart, who is our keynote speaker, who runs Unity Gardens in South Bend.
I understand there's going to be an open mic session planned for the conference. Tell us about that and how those who participate in the event are going to be able to say what they'd like to say about the topic.
Yeah, that's one of the features we're really excited about. So we wanted to make this different from the typical conference where you sort of sit still all day and listen to experts. And we wanted to build in a lot of time for people to really talk to each other and do some networking, and also for them to share their own ideas. So we feel like everybody who comes to this event tomorrow, you know, could have something valuable to share with the group. So that open mic gives them an opportunity to do that. So if folks want to get up and sing a song about food, we know we have at least one person who will be doing that. Or if they want to share a business idea or a community project idea where they're looking for allies to bring a project to life, they can get up and talk about that. Or just sort of introduce themselves and talk about what sort of people they'd like to connect with.
Legacy Foundation here in Lake County has offered a grant to help get this program underway on Wednesday, along with the sponsors for the event. Tell us where the Legacy Foundation finds this an interesting project to support.
Yeah, I think what's really cool about local food, and sometimes it gets overlooked, but it plays a role in really every aspect of our health and well-being across the community. So it's connected to, you know, physical health, obesity. It's connected to economic development. And sometimes we get excited about the technology and healthcare and all that stuff, which is great, but everybody needs to eat. So that can play a really important role in economic development as well. And then, of course, supporting the work of nonprofits and working in food access and eliminating food deserts. So we're really, really excited to have Legacy Foundation provide the grant for this event. We're a brand new organization, and we don't have funding of our own. We don't have paid staff. So it really wouldn't have happened without the Legacy Foundation.
The event's called FED, which is short for Food Expo and Discussion. It is an event that is happening on Wednesday. It'll begin with the public sessions at 9:30 in the morning. That'll happen at the County Line Orchard in Porter County. It's being put on by the Northwest Indiana Food Council, and Sarah Hyland is the president of the board of the Northwest Indiana Food Council. Sarah, thank you for being with us. Tell us about the event. Hope a lot of people show up. It's open to the public, and people can come in and learn something more about food if they're not aware of it, and ways to help do their part to reduce the number of food deserts in Northwest Indiana and make sure that enough people not only eat, but get to eat the right kinds of things. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Chris. Thanks for helping us spread the word about FED.
If you've noticed the pungent scent of a skunk more frequently lately, well, it's mating season for skunks. And Lakeshore Public Radio's Dan Clark tells us that region skunks are on the move looking for that special mate.
Whoever you are, I am Pepe Le Pew.
Love is in the air, and it smells awful as skunks are out looking for a mate. Here's Stephanie Cadlitz, director of the Moraine Ridge Wildlife Rehabilitation Center.
They do a lot more spraying. Sometimes the female will spray the male if she does not want to mate with him.
Not a good situation for desperate male skunks. However, dogs and cats also have a high risk of reaping the wrath of a startled skunk out on the prowl. Cadlitz says skunks are more active at night, especially during mating season. So she says it's a good idea to take steps to ensure your yard is skunk-proof.
Just being aware of areas that maybe a skunk would take up residency and be proactive about, you know, getting those areas closed off so that you don't have a situation.
The Moraine Ridge Wildlife Center takes in injured and orphaned wildlife, primarily in Northwest Indiana, with the goal of rehabilitating them and returning them to the wild. For Lakeshore Public Radio, I'm Dan Clark.
It's time to check in on some of the latest business news across Northwest Indiana, not only dealing with the steel industry locally, but some other areas that affect our economy as well. And for that, we are turning to Joseph Peet, who is the business reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana. And Joseph joins us from his desk in the newsroom in Munster. Thanks for being with us today.
Oh, thank you, Chris, for having me.
Let's start out. Let's talk about steel here. Let's talk about ArcelorMittal first, if we will, here. Seen a lot of changes in the ArcelorMittal operation, in particular the old Indiana Harbor Mill that most people think about. Like, my in-laws worked there years ago, and they remember making treks from other spots in Northwest Indiana, going up the highway to work their way into the entrance to the mill. They've had some tough times recently, but they seem to be coming back. Tell us how ArcelorMittal is making some changes and some big investments.
Yes, last year they did quite a bit of consolidation at Indiana Harbor. They shut down the aluminizing line, the galvanizing line, the 84-inch strip mill. It was part of that agreement they had signed with the United Steelworkers Union, where they're looking at the long-term viability of it, and then they're going to close like some less efficient operations and then invest into what they think is more sustainable for the long run. The union was very interested in job security, so they were one of their priorities was to get get the company to invest, and they are doing restoration work at the 80-inch hot strip mill, which will pick up some of the slack for the other one that closed, and their completed investments on the number 3 caster there. They've been investing in kind of ramping that up, but their North American business had been flagging quite a bit. The import crisis took a lot of the market share. Like, about a third of the steel was being bought was made overseas. The prices plunged from like $843 a ton back in 2014 to just $672 a ton on average last year. The conditions have been improving this year. Things are on the upswing, and they think they're in a better position now with some of the cutbacks they made. Last year was the first time they had turned an annual profit in like 5 years. They made other cuts around the globe, and they said it's made them, leaner and better positioned in a competitive marketplace.
Well, I hope that will make some difference for those folks who live in Northwest Indiana that maybe don't work for ArcelorMittal any longer. They're retired, or they at least have investments. They have stock in the company, and hopefully that they'll start to see better dividends come out of the improvements that the steelmakers made. One of the other steelmakers, of course, in Northwest Indiana that we always check in on is U.S. Steel, and system-wide, they had a big change in leadership. Tell us how that might affect the operations in Gary and other places.
Oh, yes. They named David Burritt, who's the executive vice president and chief financial officer. He came over from Caterpillar, where he'd been there for decades over in Illinois. And he is named the new president, which might suggest that CEO Mario Longhi is on the way out. They took away the president title from him. He's recently garnered a lot of media attention by making comments the company felt it had to clarify, saying that, they're going to bring back like 10,000 jobs. And the company swiftly issued a press release that, the U.S. Steel isn't going to be hiring back 10,000 people, but the steel industry as a whole might be. But he's been, very bullish about like the new administration coming in and then, the prospects it will have for the steel industry. But the company, though, this seems to be, when he had been named a couple years ago, he was named president, and then within a year, he was promoted to CEO. So it looks like the board is kind of positioning David Burritt for the new leadership position. Longhi has had the stock price since he started has jumped from like 18 a share to like 38 a share. It's kind of riding high right now. Investors are finally optimistic in the company again. He's made kind of controversial Carnegie Way cuts. He's trying to make the business, it's a very cyclical business. It does good when the economy is booming, but when the economy is doing poorly, the demand just isn't there. People aren't buying cars, people aren't buying washing machines, the demand for steel hollows out. But he's trying to streamline it so it's as efficient during, it can turn a profit during good times and bad. But that's met some pretty significant cuts. Just last year they cut like a quarter of the salaried workforce, including at the local mills and Portage and Gary and East Chicago. They idled East Chicago Tin. They've you know, they had a couple, almost 1,000 layoffs at Gary Works over the past couple of years. And then there was the controversial maintenance layoffs last summer where they took a lot of the maintenance workers and put them into, like, demoted them, put them into roving gangs or laid them off entirely. And that raised real safety concerns where the union was out rallying. The union was concerned that some of the deaths that occurred there last year might be linked to not having, you know, maintenance crews, you know, working the same places where they're comfortable and just being understaffed and not being able to get around to preventative maintenance. So he's kind of had like a you know, a mixed tenure there. It's been very good for the shareholders and everything, but the company hasn't completely tipped its hat. But it's kind of telling that they're, you know, they've stripped him of the president title and have promoted. It shows that they're at least positioning somebody else, like his grooming his successor, I guess.
You were talking here about the loss of jobs, about these 10,000 jobs that was discussed here, and about what LaLonghi was going to claim was going to come back to a U.S. deal. But you mentioned in another article recently in the Times about the fact that there have been lost about 84,000 jobs over the last decade in metals manufacturing. Our reasons, of course, we know some, but there must be probably more information about that. Tell us what you've learned.
Oh, absolutely. Yes, it's the Bureau of Labor Statistics. They track the primary metals manufacturing, which includes not just it's more telling than just the steel, because it also includes the service sectors or the service centers, but it also includes, you know, aluminum and foundries and so forth. But we're down to like 375,000 jobs nationally. We had been around at the height of the Great Recession, it was around 460,000. It's a pretty steep loss over time. And the thing is, there's serious questions about whether those jobs are ever coming back. A lot of it is the result of the import crisis, and a lot of layoffs were directly tied to China, like producing far more steel than they could consume in China or they could consume in the world, and just dumping this low-cost, cheap steel all over and flooding everybody's market. But a lot of it is just automation. And the thing is, when the companies are more automated, they don't when they realize they can produce just as much steel or anything else with fewer workers, they usually are not going to go back to adding headcount and adding the cost of additional salaries. So it's kind of, if you look at the labor BLS statistics, it's kind of showed, you know, gradual decline over time, and it's bound to just kind of continue in that direction. You can go to like finishing lines in the mills today, and you can walk a mile without seeing like a single steel worker.
Wow.
You know, that wouldn't have been the case, you know, century ago. You just don't have the it just doesn't require the manpower anymore. The trains that haul around, you know, drive around, are all automated. Like, they managed to automate so much of it.
I know that my late uncle-in-law used to talk about the fact that the things that changed. He noted the change too after retiring and from Inland Steel and coming back to the mill there and seeing the fact that he would be out there in the rail yard when he was working for the company at the time, and now you hardly see anybody out there at all doing the work that he and a lot of other people used to do as well. So I can certainly understand that. We're talking about loss of jobs. We also talk about some business problems as well here in Northwest Indiana and across the country. Shopping malls are being challenged more and more. It seems a lot more stores are closing nationally, and I understand too that this is even affecting the big box stores, like we just hear lately about H.H. Gregg filing for bankruptcy, and that they're not closing any Indiana stores. Are closing stores off on the East Coast? They've kind of extended themselves, I suspect, and probably realized that when it came time to look at the bottom line.
Yes, they are closing 88 stores nationwide, including several in Illinois. Their Northwest Indiana locations in Highland and Hobart will remain open. They are, I think, their Orland Park location. I know a lot of people go there to shop. That's going to remain open too in Illinois. They are, however, just the latest in a string. It was a very, very brutal, unforgiving holiday season. It was, you know, the sales were up, but so much of it has migrated online at this point. You've had Macy's, JCPenney, Sears, and Kmart are going to close more than 500 stores nationwide. There are tons of mall-based retailers that are just going out of business altogether. Limited have filed for bankruptcy. Wet Seal has filed for bankruptcy. American Apparel didn't really have any local locations, but they were a pretty big brand, and they went completely under. MC Sports, which once had I think 3 stores in the region, that's another big box chain. They finally filed for bankruptcy and went completely under. They just closed their Highland location, and now they're closing their last remaining one in Michigan City, and that's after we lost the Sports Authority last year, which they closed in Hobart, they closed in Calumet City. Mm-hmm. It's just been a very tough time for these brick and mortar retailers, and it's been taking a toll a bit on some of the malls. The Marquette Mall and Office Tower in Michigan City had kind of been in a long, slow decline. It featured on websites like deadmalls.com. It was very eerie in there. They finally closed off the interior portion last year because it was just basically completely empty. They still have the department stores are open, but the restaurants out front are all closed. The whole interior is closed off to the public. There are real concerns about the Maple Lane Mall in West LaPorte now because they had more than 20 tenants at one point. They're down to just two, I think. Al Supermarket had closed. The Kmart that was there was one of the ones that was slated for closure. So they have a dollar store and a Chinese buffet, I think, and that's all that's left. And the question is, if it's going to be. But, yeah, it's been, for some of the retailers, it's been pretty brutal. You have some, Southlake seems to be thriving. If you look at, our premier ones, Southlake and the Michigan City Outlet Malls, there's only, a handful of vacancies between them. They've been pretty successful at bringing in newer, fresher retailers like Forever 21 and H&M and so forth. But even they've had to turn to kind of alternative spaces you wouldn't have seen in the mall just 10 years ago. They opened the NWI Retail Training Lab with Grant in the Southlake Mall, where they're training the next generation of retail employees. And there might be a demand for that. And Walmart's funding that. It's a pretty well-funded initiative. However, there was a point where the mall space would have commanded such a premium, they never would have thought of donating some of it to an employee, a not-for-profit employee training lab. It would have been, used to bring in rent from, some retailer or another. But it's just more and more, they say it's the Amazon effect. More and more shoppers are going online, and it's just, it's starting to almost radically reshape the landscape here to where I've heard some bankers even say that they're hesitant to finance any kind of big box projects at this point because it's just such a rough business right now.
Well, Joseph, we only have about a minute or so left here. Let's finally kind of wrap things up this time around to talk about Strachan Van Til, some famous stores in Illinois as well as here in Northwest Indiana are going to be fewer in number. In particular, the Ultra stores. They're the ones that we understand from the corporate headquarters word that those are closing down. Tell us what we've learned about those stores and why they're going out of business.
Yes. I wish I had some positive news today, Chris. There was they are closing five stores, including the longtime one in Maryville, but they will be closing four stores in Illinois, including two in Chicago, Downers Grove and Lombard. They're kind of, the leases were up and they were looking at their kind of least profitable stores in their chain, the ones that weren't doing well. They said it was a very, difficult decision. They weren't looking forward to it. It was 460 jobs. They're trying to place as many people as they can into other positions. But it's an extremely competitive market right now, more so in Illinois than Indiana still, because you have a lot of, even after Dominick's closed, you had a lot more competition even entering the space to try and fill that void. With Whole Foods wrapped up its presence, and Aldi's is getting pretty big, and you have a lot of national because the Chicago market is so coveted. You have a lot of local and national competition there. And then, they're facing even the online pressure, too. In the grocery market, you have more people. The online is already supposedly capturing, up to, 10% of the business. And Strachan Van Til has been trying to adapt to that with, an Instacart thing where you can go online and order everything and then just drive up and pick up your groceries to, trying to adapt and be more convenient. But they don't have the same brand presence over there they do here. In Northwest Indiana, they're largely thought of as, the hometown grocer. They're our local grocery store. They're, people will talk about, we got the event catered with fried chicken at Shacks and so forth, but they just don't have that kind of a stronger brand over there, and they regretfully decided to kind of cut back. They said that they're looking at eliminating anything that's kind of holding the company down financially. It's still a big and successful company. They have over 30 stores, and they're they've done significant amount of renovations and investment in their Northwest Indiana locations, from Munster to Schererville to Valpo.
Right. And we know too that with that improvements that the Strachan Van Til's made in a lot of the Ultra stores, a lot of people from the South, the Chicago suburbs, travel over to Highland to the store there, and so it just means more business for the Ultra stores that are open, in particular the one in Highland and some other places too. We've got a lot more business news to talk about in the future, and that's why we asked for Joseph Peet from the Times of Northwest Indiana to join us. When we catch you again, we'll have some more to bring up as well, too. Thanks for being with us today, Joseph.
Oh, thank you very much, Chris. Hopefully next time it's more positive news.
While on a vacation stop in Mexico, Lakeshore Public Radio's Sharon Jackson asked some people about their opinions as they deal with the current immigration policy. And here's what Sharon found out.
The political climate of late with the election of President Donald Trump is turbulent. His anti-Muslim travel ban, the expanded field of undocumented immigrants targeted for deportation, Trump's repeated talk and promise of building a wall at the U.S.-Mexico border, and calling for 15,000 more Border Patrol agents and Immigration Customs Enforcement agents has sparked great anxiety among immigrants and those wanting to come to the United States. I recently traveled to almost the southernmost point of Texas to visit family. While I was there, I took a day trip to Mexico to talk to people in the border town of Progreso to get their opinions and ask about their experiences coming to the United States. I'm traveling with my father, Jim, and his wife, Frida. We are on Bill Summers International Boulevard, otherwise known as the 1015 Highway that takes you over the Rio Grande through U.S. Customs and Border Protection into Progreso, Mexico. Before crossing the border, we are greeted with a warning sign that Frida reads aloud.
Warning, into Mexico, penalty, prison. You carry illegal firearms or ammunition.
We come up to a toll booth, and much to my dad's dismay, the toll price into Mexico has gone up.
$3?
$3, yes, sir.
It used to be $1.50.
Way back?
Way back.
Thank you.
Then we come to the U.S. Customs and Border Protection Inspection Station, where officers are inspecting the trunks of cars and even the back of an empty pickup truck. Then it's our turn. I took a couple of pictures, and that was not looked upon favorably.
Hello.
Open the door, please.
I think it's open.
Okay. Wait, no, no está permitido tomar fotos.
No.
Pictures, no permitido.
Oh, okay.
¿Las puede borrar clean?
What?
Clean.
No camera.
De foto, fotografía, clean, borrar.
Y no comprende.
Nada, le checamos. A ver, ¿cuál es tomó? ¿Me permite su celular?
You want my camera?
Ajá, para ver qué fotos tomó.
Wait, what do you want my
de
camera?
De captura foto.
What?
La foto capturada.
Can't take
it. Oh, I have to take a picture? I have to pay you?
Sí, a ver.
How
¿puedes
much?
Decirle que...
estuvo tomando fotos de su celular?
Erase it.
Aquí, a mí...
A oh, erase it.
Okay, I can see your gallery. Your... Ajá. Uh-huh. This four delete, please.
Okay, why?
Is no.
You're not allowed to take it.
No photography, office.
Okay.
Office. It's okay.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Gracias.
Thank you.
We head over to the duty free store, which is just over the border, and the cashier Cheryl is American.
Where are you from?
New Hampshire.
Where do you live now?
Oh, over here.
You live in Mexico?
Uh huh. Yeah, my husband's Mexican.
Nice.
Don't tell Donald Trump. Yeah. Here's your receipt. If you're walking, our depot's open if you want to leave again.
Yeah, we're in the
car. We go further down the street where people appear to be having a great time, shopping, drinking at the outdoor counter at a local bar, and listening to local musicians. Progreso is a very busy area full of Americans shopping and Mexicans trying to earn a living. There is a pharmacy just about every three stores, several dentist offices, and street vendors selling everything from purses to leather belts to jewelry to t-shirts to big wooden beer mugs with the logos of NFL football teams on them. Street vendors are everywhere, and I engage one in conversation and tell him I'm a reporter from the U.S.
What's your name?
Sammy.
Sammy?
Yes.
Do you ever go over to the other side? Do you ever go to the United
yeah.
States?
Yes.
Has it been harder for you? Since to get over there?
No, I cross the border like nothing.
Really?
Yeah.
Are you a Mexican citizen?
Yeah.
So how often do you go over to the States?
Every time I want to.
And what's it like for you crossing over?
Like nothing. I mean, it's normal. I mean, no problem.
How long have you been living here?
A long time.
You live in Progreso?
Yes.
Okay. How long have you been living here?
15 years.
Where are you from originally?
Salvador, Central America.
What brought you up here?
Americans. I like to practice my English.
I continue to walk down the street, and employees from the shops just off the busy main drag stand on the sidewalk trying to get potential customers to come in for a manicure or pedicure. Frida and I follow a man from one of the shops into a salon, and another shopkeeper sees us and shows his disappointment at us walking into his competitor's place across the courtyard. We get settled in, and I try to engage my manicurist in conversation, but we have a language barrier.
Yeah, you know what? I'm a reporter out of Chicago. I just want to ask you guys your opinions on some stuff. Is that okay?
Chicago?
Yeah.
Do you understand your name?
Yeah. That's my elder.
Huh? No, you want a picture?
Picture? No. I don't want a picture.
Quiere algo, pero no sé qué diseño. Esmeralda, ¿por qué no quitas esa silla de té? Es una chiquita de adentro, porque se puede mover ahí.
They call another shop employee over who speaks English. Her name is Lydia Rosanna Gregg, and she is from Guatemala.
I'm a reporter out just outside of Chicago with Lakeshore Public Radio.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Ella es una reportera. Y quiere reportar lo que está pasando desde aquí para Chicago, para que lo den a conocer el servicio que ustedes dan. ¿Está bien?
Yeah.
See? Yeah, it's fine. So you're putting what she's doing to you or what?
Oh yeah, I just wanted to ask you guys your opinions on the new U.S. president Donald Trump. What do you guys think about the whole thing he wants to do with the wall and stuff? What's your opinion on all that? Has that changed anything around here?
I don't think so. You know what I mean? He will never will do that. In my opinion, he never will do that.
Mm-mm.
Why? Because we never going to stop to try to get into United States.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
He's not nobody to decide what to do in our lives.
Okay.
Yeah, I was deported a long time ago too. That's why I'm here in Mexico. I was deported since 2012.
Oh, you've been here since 2012?
Yes. Yeah.
In Progreso?
No, in my country. And so that's why I'm here, because my kids are United States citizens.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, my husband too is citizen.
Oh.
So I have to wait until my time is done. 2023, I think, is finished. So after that, I go back to the United States. If Trump don't want it, I mean, I have to get in, you know what I mean? With my right papers. Okay?
Yeah. So what, I don't understand. So wait, what do you mean your time is done?
Because 10 years punishment.
For what?
For getting illegal in the United States. I used to live 17 years in there. Okay.
Uh-huh.
And they caught me, and they say you have to go back to your country. Yeah, June 2012, they go arrest me to my house for go back to Guatemala. I was for 3 months in jail. Yeah, it was kind of hard. It's not easy to live that being legal in United States. And now I feel so sorry for those are inside. And I don't know if it's true everything was happening, but we have to pray and live in God's hands. He's the only one. He take care of us. And take care of your country too. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I know many people like you, they don't agree what's happening. And many, yes, they're so happy. You know what I mean? Maybe many people, they're not happy what they're doing, and some people, they're happy what they're doing. You know what I mean? But, like I said again, God's no. That God will touch his heart, Trump's heart, you know, to see what to do. We decided that that's fine for us, right? So.
Thank you so much.
No problem.
Nice talking to you.
Nice to meet you.
When our manicures are done, we head back out to the bustling street, and there's still so much more I want to ask Lydia Rosanna. So I go back and find her, and when I do, I ask her about her kids and her husband.
He's American.
Is he?
Yeah.
And how many kids? Three?
I have three boys.
And they're American?
Yeah, they're citizens.
Oh,
yes.
Okay. Uh-huh. And you're not then?
No, I'm not with them because they take me out of the country. Yeah.
They came to your house, you said, and arrested
you? Yes, they come into my house with a big lawyer. They say they're looking for somebody. So we open the door, you know what I mean? And when we open the door, and he's saying, your name is Lita Rosanna de Leon Valencia. I say, yes, okay, we are ICE, you know what I mean? They're lying to us. And they get it to arrest me in the front of my kids. I say, do not take me out in the front of my kids. Let me talk to them. No, he said, you don't have permission to talk to them. So they take me out to my house. They take out all my papers. I have it with me. And I put them in some kind of van, you know what I mean?
When did that happen?
That happened September 9th, 2012.
And you were in jail?
I was in jail for 3 months. My husband tried to fight my case, so like that maybe I can stay in the United States. And they was kind of mad with my husband, all right? And so they put me in different jail. I was in Wichita, Kansas jail, all right? But when they saw that my husband tried to fight my case, they moved me out quickly, all right, as soon as possible, to bring me to different states. I don't remember what the name of the states. For maybe 5 weeks, I wasn't there. Then the airplane was ready for me to go back to my country.
But yeah. Where did they take you?
Guatemala. You know what I mean? Straight to Guatemala. Yeah.
Were you in jail in Guatemala too?
No, I don't was in jail. They only take me, brought me an airplane, and then after that, I go straight to Guatemala, and then they take me the ANCAF? Mm-hmm. Stuff? Yeah. And that's it. I never saw my kids again. You know what I mean?
And that was back in, the last time you saw your kids was in 2012?
2012, yeah, but my husband bring it to me sometimes. You know what I mean? So now I'm here in Mexico because I was getting crazy in my country, in Guatemala. Because I want to see my kids, you know what I mean? Because
sure.
I want to see my kids and enjoy with them, right? So I told my husband I want to come close to them. They're from Wichita, Kansas. So they saw everything to move to Nuevo Paraiso, Texas. So they're living right here. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And I am here, right? So like I had a chance to see my kids every weekend. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Are you going to go back to the States at any time?
No, right now. My time is up. So I have 5 more years left.
And then what happens in 5 years?
And my husband has to start my case again and see if they give me permission to come back legally to the United States. I hope so. I mean, that will work. If you know, I don't know. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But at least I'm happy right now. I can see my kids.
Yeah.
Because the family is supposed to be together. And I know I broke the rules. I understand and I respect that. All right? But I know I was doing nothing illegal. Only want a chance to stay, but they not let me to stay. So, I mean, you have to do what they say, right? But the thing we was mad with is because they lied to us. We opened the door, we was thinking they was looking for some person, and there was nobody that was looking for me.
Who did you think they were?
When I saw them, so there was the only cops, all right?
Mm-hmm.
But ICE, immigration, was behind them. So they say they come into my house, and they ask me, who is Leader Rosanna? I say, that's me. Why? You on the rest. Yeah. You know, I mean, that was kind of hard for me and my kids too, and my husband. Yeah.
What was it like in jail for 3 months?
Oh, this is awful. Be careful with that. Yeah, it's awful being there because they make you get up at 5 o'clock in the morning. You sleep in there really cold because they turn on the AC. Zero under, you know what I mean? Yeah, it's kind of hard to be in there, but you know what? You have to handle. It's kind of crazy. Many people in one room, we sleep maybe 20 girls in one room.
Lydia Rosanna's boys are 14, 12, and 10 years old. Lydia says her husband tried to get a lawyer right after she was arrested, but he was told that it didn't matter if he hired a lawyer. Lydia would be taken out of the U.S. anyway because she already had the deportation.
So do you plan on going over back to the States when your time is up?
Yes, I'm planning because my kids are not happy. Actually, they're in the United States, living in the United States, but they're still not happy. You know what I mean?
How are you going to get there?
I'm waiting for my time is up, and my husband have a plan to hire a lawyer again. And, well, let's go see what's happening, what the lawyer's saying, and what the judge going to say, too, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, all depends. Like I said inside, I leave this in God's hands, you know what I mean? But right now I'm so happy because I can see my kids most in the weekends. Yeah, better than nothing.
For Lakeshore Public Radio, I'm Sharon Jackson.
And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you very much for being with us. Back with you tomorrow.